I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Melanie Gorlick, Senior Vice President of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Moadim L'Simcha. We have completed the High Holy Days, and so, naturally, the Jewish calendar launches us immediately into another major festival, Sukkot. This is a time of year of great joy for Jews. Starting tomorrow night, Monday night, we begin celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. Actually, my favorite, personally, Jewish festival, in part because it's not Yom Kippur. No, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality of it, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and on its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot's the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that's one of the truly ancient ones on our very complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, huts outside the house that we decorate with fruits and vegetables in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, and it is filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot's the Jewish Thanksgiving. In fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on this biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Booths, established in the Torah. It was particularly important for our ancestors whose whole lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter, and it was something for which to truly be grateful. The reason Sukkot was the most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals was likely because it fell at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in the early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop in Israel, which must be harvested. But there are many other crops still growing that need to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of the Holy Land. But Sukkot, well, that comes in the fall, when all the crop yields are complete and the harvest is in. It's a time of plenty, and was an easier time to take a week to travel to the capital of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing their agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, and enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of great joy and celebration of food and drink and conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot's the time when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of a sukkah. usually open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome in. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and the etrog, the four species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, symbolizing the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests, although this year they should all be, appropriately masked and socially distanced, except when we're outside, perhaps, as appropriate in these strange pandemic times. Even luminaries from the Jewish past are invited into our sukkah. They are called ushpizin, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, Solomon, and so on. Everyone is supposed to enjoy Sukkot with us. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah called Asukkele, and here it is.
Asukkele, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir Asukkele gemacht, badechtem da. Bezeles khan zit sich mir in sikle bana padektem da mit bezeles khan zit sich mir in sikle bana. Wind a kalten, lust doch die Spalten, in die lechterlich sei, löschen sich viel. Es is mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die lechterlich sei brennen ganz still. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die Lechterle sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht soll dir die Sicke nicht sein Bang. Es ist schon gute bald 2000 Jahre, in die Sicke lese ich steigt noch ganz lang. Es ist schon gute
That was a pretty little Yiddish song, Asukkele, for the Holiday of Booths, coming this week. By the way, in Europe, homes were built with a room with a retractable roof that could actually be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than 2 permanent walls. So these interior sukkahs made some accommodation, constructing extra walls inside the house. That speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday, and to being Jewishly observant that entire homes were designed with a sukkah, used only 7 or 8 days a year, in mind. When we return on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest and friend Jonathan Ornstein joins us from Krakow, Poland. He is the executive director of the dynamic JCC of Krakow. We'll discuss the recent spate of stories in the news about rising anti-Semitism in Poland and evaluate the challenges posed by the diplomatic dust-up between Israel and Poland that has emerged over the past couple of months. Find out all about it from a key player on the scene when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to register, or just come. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely, but in person. You can call 520-276-5675 for more information as well. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Come to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is BeitSimcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience, every Shabbat. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through our website, www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available for all ages of children in blended formats as well, some students live and some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our fantastic religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our friend Jonathan Ornstein, the executive director of the Jewish Community Center in Krakow, a past winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much. Good to speak with you, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, a happy Sukkot. Tell us a little bit about some of the trends. When I visited Poland last, people talked about how great the relationship was. Krakow has always seemed almost philo-Semitic in the times I visited, but there have been some disturbing stories in the news. Can you give us kind of a little overview?
Absolutely. I would say, though, that as is very often the case, sometimes relations on a official government level and things that are you know, between countries don't always necessarily affect and trickle down to what's happening here on the ground. So I'm happy to report that although there have been issues, which I'll talk about in a second, between Israel and Poland, and it's a bit of a war of words, that things here in Krakow and in Poland continue to be good for the Jewish community. We continue to grow and thrive, and we're not seeing any real increase, uptick in anti-Semitism or any threat to the community, which is, of course, for us, the most important. So that's great. But it is true that there have been issues in the last month or so, between Poland and the worldwide Jewish community, and really between Poland and Israel. Poland passed a certain law which deals with putting a time limit on how long people have to try to get property back that was taken from them, and this is a property that affects a lot of people, including Jews, and the Jewish world reaction has been very negative, especially Israel, especially Yair Lapid, who, as the foreign minister, said a lot of very extreme, I would say, comments, which kind of helped added some fuel to the fire. So that's essentially the background of what's going on. But the issue of restitution is something that's always very, very complicated in Poland, especially if you think about a country that had such a large Jewish population before the war, with over 90% being murdered. So there was a lot of property and the question of the ownership of that. And you have first the Germans taking over the country, and then afterwards the everything nationalized during communism. So it's a lot to unpack.
It's a complicated question, and obviously a long and complicated relationship with Poland. We will talk much more with Jonathan Ornstein from Krakow of the JCC when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked, and Chag Sameach, I should say. Happy holiday.
Also to you.
We talked last week about Afghanistan, once about the last Jew of Afghanistan. You had a really unusual experience with the Taliban leadership. You want to share that story?
I'd be happy to. And actually, it's very apropos because I just went through boxes and boxes that my parents had accumulated over the 68 years of their marriage. And they never threw out anything that was ever written to them by me or my brother.
Wow.
So I found this incredible series of letters from when I was posted in Pakistan, and particularly the first part of my assignment there. And the letters were written roughly every 2-3 weeks, so more than once a month, but they covered only maybe my first 6 months, and they were all the impressions of someone who was new. And don't forget, when you're in the Foreign Service, you're not only new to a country or new to a region, you're new to a working environment filled with people you don't know. You're new to a house that has a household staff. And at first, I was terribly confused by the fact that most of these people were referred to by their functions and not by their names. So there's an Urdu word for the sweeper, the gardener, the cook, the guy who does the toilets, whatever. They all have their own professional names, but then you eventually learn their personal names as well. And there's a whole learning curve when you get to a new post. And these letters reflected that in part, but they also reflected my first official trip into Afghanistan to meet with the leadership of several factions, which were then vying for ultimate control of Afghanistan. The Taliban started with 5 or 10% of the national territory under their control. And during my years there, that percentage grew to about 90%. And eventually they had it all after I left. But when I did meet with them, there were three guys whose names I didn't know and whose functions were not very clear. And they were seated on a couch. And I, the vice consul from Peshawar, American, fellow American, who's kind of knew one of the two Afghan languages, and a professional interpreter was sitting on the other couch. And there was a coffee table between us that was covered with the traditional offering at every meeting in Central Asia, which is pistachios, almonds, walnuts, dried apricots, white raisins, and black raisins. Those six things. And then each person gets a steaming bowl of hot green tea. And they gestured that we should serve ourselves. And I said, thank you for sharing the Lord's bounty with us. And this was interpreted, and their chins hit the floor, and there was a big jabber, 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 huge commotion. And I kind of whispered to the interpreter, did I say something wrong? He said, no, on the contrary, you said something very right. Because these guys were always taught that Americans were infidels and didn't believe in God. And you just invoked God's name in the same way they would have. So that and one other thing got me great street cred with these guys, who really were the top three of the Taliban leaders at the time, unbeknownst to me.
Wow. Oof.
The other thing was that, you know, maybe half an hour into our meeting, they got a call to prayer, and I could hear it. And they said, well, sorry, we have to go pray. It's been nice meeting you. I said, well, can't we resume after you pray? I mean, your prayers take like 3 minutes. They said, that's true, but every other American we ever met said, time is money. Don't expect me to just sit here while you go and pray. So I said, well, I'm not every other American. I'm happy to sit here while you go and pray. So they came back, and then there was another call to prayer, and they came back again. And the fact that I was willing to sit through this and respect their religious practices obviously made them relax, and they kind of metaphorically loosened their ties, and they started smiling and making jokes. And then they said, are you guys taken care of for dinner? Because food can be hard to come by here in Kandahar. And we said, well, that's very kind of you, but we're staying in the UN guest house, and they're not going to eat dinner till we come back. So we feel obliged at some point to return so that they can eat dinner. Thank you. Maybe next time. And that was like exactly the right thing to say also, because they considered very important to be a man of honor and to honor your word. So I lucked out.
Boy, you filled the day with mitzvot there. That was really intentional or otherwise. That's a great story, Tom. And I'm glad that your parents kept your letters, because for that story alone, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi was so addicted to golf that he snuck out to play golf between the morning and afternoon services on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, holiest day of the year. Up in heaven, Moses said to God, "What a disgrace. a Jew playing golf on Yom Kippur, and a rabbi to boot. God responded, I'll teach him a lesson. On the course, the rabbi stepped up the first tee, bombed his drive down the fairway. His ball ricocheted off a sprinkler head, a cart path, and a bunker rake, hit the green, bounced four times, and rolled into the cup. This is how you teach him a lesson, God, said Moses. He got a hole in one. Sure, said God. But who's he going to tell? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, is easy to overlook in the context of the fast flow of fall festivals. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur follow just 4 days later by this harvest festival, whose principal observances seem based in an earlier age, the agricultural celebration of bringing in the fruits, vegetables and grains that carry us through a barren winter. In today's world, where food comes from across the globe and virtually any kind of produce is available year-round, a particular week to celebrate reaping the rewards of the natural world might seem archaic. But the move in recent years towards locally sourced produce and grains produced from sustainable agricultural methods, from native seeds, and finding fruits, vegetables, and other natural products at farmers' markets and through growers' cooperatives, well, that testifies to an understanding that what we produce from the ground nearby, with God's help, is the best food to eat and serve our children. There is nothing tastier than ripe, fresh vegetables and fruits, harvested recently at the proper time and season. They taste better, offer many health and environmental benefits, as well as for us and for the planet. Perhaps that's just the way God intended us to live. For our ancestors in ancient Israel, Sukkot was considered to be the most important observance of all, called Hechag, the holiday in the Mishnah, as though we're the only one, which of course it's not. Of all the festivals, this is the one most often referred to in the Bible, and it must have been the one on which most people came to Jerusalem to express their gratitude to God. It was far easier to make that pilgrimage on foot to the holy city when the harvest was in than it would have been so in the spring when the planting and weeding need to be done, or the early summer when the first crops had to be harvested. Sukkot in ancient Jerusalem must have been an incredible scene. Sukkahs all over the city, songs and feasts for the full week for everyone. Today, our focus on Sukkot is on thanksgiving to God for the bounty of the harvest. This season, known as Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, is blessed with Torah readings that focus primarily on the rituals of the ancient festival, with some additional mystical passages. Here, too, the Torah reminds us we exist solely through the grace of God, and we offer thanks for the natural world God created to help provide for our needs. A really great reminder this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Jonathan Ornstein of the JCC of Krakow, Poland, reassures us that life for Jews in Poland today is actually quite good, in spite of what you might be hearing on the news. Find out what's really going on there when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Ida Nudel, one of the most prominent activists to campaign for the right of Jews to leave the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s, died in Israel last week at the age of 90. Ida Nudel was born in the Soviet Union in 1931 and came to prominence in the 70s as a leading activist for the rights of jailed Soviet Jews and as a famous refusnik, one of thousands barred from leaving the country at the time. Ida Nudel sought permission to leave for 16 years, but Soviet authorities denied her an exit visa on the grounds that she might have heard state secrets while working as an accountant at a state institution in the Soviet Union. Her sister and family were allowed to immigrate to Israel in 1971, but she was left behind. She spent 4 years in Siberian exile for hanging a poster on her Moscow balcony in 1978 that read, KGB, give me my visa. After she was released in 1982, she was banned from living in major Soviet cities. Her cause was championed by American actress Jane Fonda. Her story was fictionalized in the 1987 Italian film Mosca Addio, Farewell Moscow, starring Liv Ullmann. In 1987, she was allowed to move to Israel, where she was greeted by thousands of people on the tarmac and welcomed by Israeli leaders. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett called New Delhi a symbol of the struggle for immigration from the Soviet Union and a role model of a Jewish heroine. Yuli Edelstein, an Israeli lawmaker and fellow former refusenik, said on Twitter, she was one of the great icons of the struggle for the right to immigrate to Israel from the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, in recent years, said Edelstein, I accompany more and more of my brothers and sisters, prisoners of Zion, on their final journey. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken hosted a virtual meeting last week with his counterparts from Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco, marking the first anniversary of normalization agreements between those Arab countries and Israel. The event was the Biden administration's highest-profile display of support for the so-called Abraham Accords, widely seen as a diplomatic triumph for former President Donald Trump. President Joe Biden has backed the deals since taking office in January, and senior aides have said they were working to get additional Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel after decades of enmity. But the administration until now had been cool to the idea of commemorating the anniversary of the accords. The leaders of Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain signed the Abraham Accords at the White House in September of 2020. Israel and Sudan announced the following month they would normalize relations, and Morocco established diplomatic ties with Israel in December, after Biden defeated Trump in the U.S. election. Palestinian officials have said they felt betrayed by their Arab brethren for reaching deals with Israel without first demanding progress toward the creation of a Palestinian state. Until last year, only two states, Egypt and Jordan, had forged full ties with Israel. The Abraham Agreements have led to a slew of trade and investment deals. This event commemorates the one-year anniversary of the signing of the Abraham Accords. We are discussing ways to further deepen ties and build a more prosperous region, said the State Department. Avi Berkowitz, the former Middle East envoy who helped broker the accords together with Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner, wrote on Twitter, "Thank you to the Biden administration and specifically Secretary Blinken for supporting the Abraham Accords." Ryan Braun, the Milwaukee Brewers outfielder who has slugged more home runs than any Jewish player in baseball history and won a Most Valuable Player award, announced his retirement last week, officially ending a 14-year career that was not without controversy. "While it's impossible to summarize my emotions right now, what I feel most is one simple thing, gratitude," said Braun. Well, that's appropriate for a suit coat. The 37-year-old Southern California outfielder was drafted fifth overall by Milwaukee in the 2005 Major League Baseball draft. He made his debut 2 years later and went on to win the National League Rookie of the Year in 2007 and the league's MVP in 2011. He won five Silver Slugger Awards and was a six-time All-Star. Ryan Braun played his entire career in Milwaukee, finishing as a .296 hitter, just under .300, with 352 home runs, most ever by any Jewish player. He also had 1,154 RBIs, but he has not played in 2021. Those accolades for Braun come with an asterisk. Following his 2011 MVP performance, Braun tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs, PEDs, reportedly lied about it, but escaped punishment because of botched lab work by Major League Baseball. But Braun was caught again in 2013, serving a 65-game suspension. The slugger's reputation was tarnished, especially among Jewish fans. Occasionally known as the Hebrew Hammer, Ryan Braun is the son of an Israeli father. "I consider myself definitely Jewish," Braun has said. "I'm extremely proud to be a role model for young Jewish kids." And now he has retired. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our friend Jonathan Ornstein, the executive director of the remarkable Jewish Community Center in Krakow, Poland. If you haven't been there, highly recommend visiting. Talking about the situation of not only the Jewish community in Poland now, but some of the official relations, which have become very complicated. Jonathan, we started talking earlier about the restitution law. As you noted, perhaps 3.5 million Jews in Poland before the Holocaust, obviously a tremendous amount of Jewish property that was confiscated by the Nazis, given to various people. Restitution, some 70 years after the event, is very complicated. Can you try to unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. So I think essentially what happened lately is that the government passed a law which has a negative effect on a lot of people that have legitimate claims to property, including Jews. And the Jewish world reaction, especially Israel's, was seeing this as anti-Semitic. But it's a little more complicated than that, because I think what the backstory is that the problem is really that Poland doesn't have a law, a specific law dealing with individual Jewish property. So if there was communal property, synagogues and schools and things that were taken, they have been given back to the community. There's a special mechanism to give that back, and that happens for the Jews and also with the Catholic Church, that of course had many, many buildings that were nationalized, and then those were given back to the church. So where there's a problem in Poland, which is really the backstory here, is that there's no, as opposed to other countries in Europe, which almost all of them in this part of the world have a special mechanism that Jews can go, a special law that Jews can then go and try to, you know, show that they property was taken from them and get this property back. A law because of the special nature of the genocide and what happened to the Jewish people here in the Holocaust, that there's an understanding that the normal burden of proof and having, you know, papers and things is obviously very difficult for Jews and more difficult than for others who had things taken during communism or during or by the Germans. So the problem with this law, as I see it, is really that there should have been a law before it. So this law on the surface is something that was in some ways even necessary in Poland, because you have a lot of corruption and a lot of problems with people falsifying documents. And at the end of the day, the government had to say, wait a minute, we can't just indefinitely give all of these things back. So we're creating this law and saying 30 years. So I think the law makes sense, except I think it should have been preceded by another law which would have dealt with Jewish property. So I think that the Holocaust, because of the special nature of it, and what happened to the victims and the property, I think that it shouldn't be affected by this law. So it's a little more complicated than sometimes people are making it out. I think it's a lot more complicated than some politicians in Israel have been painting it. But still, it's problematic. But really, it's not exactly this law that's problematic. It's the entire situation, which doesn't provide a special mechanism for Jews that have been that have lost property because of their families in the Holocaust, that they don't have a mechanism to try to get that property back.
Yeah, I mean, I had a guest on not too long ago, wrote a book about trying to recover property for his family, or eventually to some degree successful in Poland. Very complicated process, very difficult. Let's talk a little bit about not only this issue, but sort of the nationalist government in Poland and what they started to say. They said some things in exchange after Yair Lapid said very strong things about Poland. Then there was something about the March of the Living. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, essentially it became a bit of a war of words, and Poland then said that maybe they would reconsider the trips that come, the sort of Holocaust-focused trips that come to Poland, which Poland feels are very negative about Poland. I mean, obviously that's hard to avoid being negative about a place where genocide happened, even if it was by the Germans at that point when Poland was occupied. But still, you know, Poland is always a bit of a sore spot. And if you think about it from the Polish point of view, which the Holocaust happened in Poland, occupied Poland, done by the Germans. But if you want to learn about the Holocaust, you don't go to Germany, the country of the perpetrators, you go to Poland, a country which was also victimized by Germany, but had the bad fortune of having the camps here. So it's always a little, I think, painful for Poland, although obviously necessary that this should happen, these trips, but a little painful for Poland that people come to see, often visitors come only to see the Holocaust. So this is something that we in Krakow have worked hard to try to show a larger part of the country and the Jewish experience. You know, 1,000 years of Jewish life, both before the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, Jewish death, really, and then Jewish life once again. So Poland is always a little bit uncomfortable with the nature of these trips. So they, I think that was the thing that they didn't ban those trips, but they sort of started some rumblings a little bit that maybe we should just take a look at those with this. So just unfortunate. I think Israel and Poland are generally have very good relations. If you take a 15, 20-year view of it, Poland is probably Israel's best friend and most, you know, staunchest supporter in the EU in terms of voting with it and not voting against it, and really military, economic, educational, social, tourist relations, very, very good. So that's why it's painful when these things happen and things happen that adversely affect the relationship.
The fascinating part, I think, for anybody visiting Poland for the first time, particularly Krakow, is the very positive interest in Judaism. The JCC has been not only a symbol of that, it's been emblematic of that, the large number of non-Jews interested in Judaism, interested in support of the Jewish community. That's not as true in Warsaw, is it?
I think in Krakow, Jewish life is more visible. There's a larger community in Warsaw. There are more organizations. There are more people, more synagogues. There's a lot more of everything. But, you know, in Krakow, we're very lucky to have a mostly intact Jewish quarter, which sort of makes everything more visible. If you visit Krakow, you're aware right away of the Jewish presence, where in Warsaw, it's a little bit more hidden in the city.
In the last, I don't know, maybe it's been 10 years, there's been a rise in nationalism in Poland. Can you talk a little bit about the nationalist kind of movement in Poland?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a rise in nationalism in many places in the world.
Including the United States. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say including the United States, but certainly in this part of the world, there's been a sort of reactionary movement to certain things, whether that's to refugees, whether that's to technology that makes certain blue-collar jobs less viable. but certainly the world has gone in that direction, whether it's Brexit, whether it's Trumpism in the United States, or what we see in this part of the world, essentially Poland and Hungary moving to the right. It's an issue. It's an issue. I don't feel that this government is necessarily anti-Semitic. I think that this government has issues with accurately portraying Polish history. So this is where the nationalist aspect comes in. They're very eager to portray Poles as heroes who saved the Jews, and they're much more reticent to acknowledge the more complicated aspects of Polish Jewish history, including anti-Semitism pre-war and during the war and post-war even. So it's an issue. It's definitely an issue, and we are constantly trying to affect the government and talk to them and have them present a more balanced view of the Holocaust and even the role sometimes that Poles took, not only Poles that saved Jews, but we all know very well that there were many Poles who harmed Jews during the war. And
we collaborated with the Nazis.
Look at it honestly and objectively and celebrate those who helped us and condemn those who hurt us.
I would assume if you're Polish and you see Poland as victims of the Nazis, which was certainly the case, Nazis murdered many Poles, destroyed large parts of cities. Warsaw was completely annihilated. It must be very difficult to say, well, some of us were complicit. Has Poland done that kind of self-examination regardless of the Jewish question?
So you're exactly right. This is a complicated issue because Poland rightfully does see itself overall as a victim in World War II and a victim beyond. Poland was partitioned by Austria, Germany, and Russia for 123 years right, until World War I. So Poland has, there's a national identity of being a victim, and that doesn't sit very well with the idea of also the victim at times being the aggressor and victimizing others. I think Poland was doing a very good job previously dealing with this. Some books that came out that provoked, like by Jan Gross, by Grabowski, that started to focus on these more difficult, painful elements of Polish-Jewish relations. And they were not easy for the country to swallow and to deal with, but they provoked the dialogue that was necessary and cathartic. But this government got elected, and their mantra has been very much that Poland shouldn't apologize. Poland was a victim. Poland was a place where they saved Jews. And this sort of, I think this soul searching has been on hold for the most part for the last 5 or so years that this government has been in charge. But I think it's something that the Polish people were willing and able to deal with, but it's difficult. Again, this is part of their national, really, psyche, of this idea of they were attacked, they were victims, and historically they're one of Europe's, this idea that Poland is the Christ among nations, the always suffering nation, and it just doesn't fit into that. It doesn't fit easily into their narrative of the fact that they also hurt others at times.
All right. So now the question that everybody wants to know is, still in the midst of all this COVID challenge, are you planning the Ride for the Living next June?
The burning question. We are planning the Ride for the Living 2021. The last 2 years have been very successful, but virtual.
Virtual,
we had,
correct.
3,000 people this year all over the world. Pedaling as if they were with us and riding from Auschwitz to JCC, as you've done with your son. But I'm proud to say, and you're hearing it here first on Too Jewish, that Ride for the Living 2022 will be back, assuming that everything continues, the world continues to heal, or by then is in reasonable shape, but we will have an in-person ride from Auschwitz to JCC Krakow. The ride itself will be on July 1st, 2022.
Ah, well, this is very important to know. I got to share a story. One of the riders was friends with one of the great American cyclists, And I had the privilege of saying that I was able to ride in the Ride for the Living with a Greg LeMond, a two-time or three-time Tour de France winner. Three-time. Super nice guy. He just came out to support the JCC of Krakow. And at one point, he was chatting with somebody, and I rode past him. And I turned to Boaz and I said, I can always say that I passed on a cycle Greg LeMond. You know, like this is my one claim to fame. Anyway, it's a fantastic place, the JCC of Krakow. Ride the Living is a great experience. I'm glad it was good virtual, but I have to say it's amazing in person. Where can people go to find out more about the JCC of Krakow and maybe about more about Polish Judaism in general?
Sure. JCCKrakow.org, rideforthelivingorg. And if you go to, I think on our website, there'll also be some links for some other resources to be able to learn more about Polish Jewry today.
As always, Jonathan Arnstein, thank you so much for being here on Too Jewish. A good year, a healthy year for everybody, and a Chag Sameach.
Gam lecha. Great talking to you, and all the best.
Thank you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Dr. Nir Barzilai, fantastic guest, the aging and longevity expert, author of Age Later, Health Span, Lifespan, and the New Science of Longevity, talking about Ashkenazic populations of extremely long, healthy lives, why we age, and what new drug treatments, including metformin, may mean for the future of living long, healthier lives. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. for services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person or on Facebook Live. Our playout this morning comes for the holiday of Sukkot that starts tomorrow night at sunset, continuing for a joyous week plus of meals, friends, and outdoor joy. Benny Friedman is singing Adi Ron's beautiful song, Ata HaKadosh, I am small, but you, God, are holy, from the classic Sukkot film from Israel, Ushbizin. If you haven't seen it recently, find it online and watch it for Sukkot again this year. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach and a Moadim L'Simcha, a festival of joy, a healthy week, God willing, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
דרכים רבות הלכתי לחפש כל טוב אמת לא היססתי מלנגוס פה במעדן אחר לא מצאנו את עצמנו אין אותם לכחש התרבות הזאת לא לנו כי בליבנו יש מניע קטן השפל שבין כולם ובתו נראה את מדידה ואני הקטן האחרון שבעם ובתו נרגש ונפרח
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.